I believe not only that education is a protective factor, it is everything, because it is the brain that has the power to do enormous good on the planet. I wanted to instill a love of learning.
To talk to young people about how to negotiate their own well-being, and hopefully to tap into some of the adults that might be working with those young people to get them to identify specific elements of their character and talent that will lead them into a right relationship with our community.
To me, the most important project is to create space for young people who've been pushed out of school, who've been on the streets, who've just been in survival mode to think about the possibilities. Mm-hmm. It's literally what motivates me in this work. Like, and we cultivate learning.
I'm Shane Murphy Goldsmith, President and CEO of Liberty Hill Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to a very special pre-season episode of Conversations from the Frontlines. Recorded before a live audience at our annual Leadership Appreciation Brunch, we spoke to frontline organizers and advocates about the work they're leading to dismantle punishment systems, expand opportunities, and transform outcomes for young people of color. In this episode, we also go behind the scenes of Liberty Hill's new Liberation Fund, a groundbreaking initiative to end incarceration of girls and gender-expansive youth in LA County.
Judge Lucero, Jessica, Monique, I'm Shane, CEO of Liberty Hill Foundation, in case you're new. Hi, everyone. So I have the wonderful pleasure of moderating this discussion with our amazing panelists. We've recently launched our Liberation Fund here at Liberty Hill. Who's heard about it before today, the Liberation Fund? Wonderful. So we've heard a lot from Dr. Kufson. I would love to hear from Jessica and Judge Lucero about who are you. Introduce yourselves. Tell us about your personal journey and how that's led you to do this work.
Hey, everyone. My name is Jessica Nowlin. I am president of Reimagine Freedom and Young Women's Freedom Center. Young Women's Freedom Center has been around 30 years this year. We started in San Francisco as an organization that hired girls, gender-expansive youth who had lived and worked in the streets, been in foster care, and been incarcerated. This was the early 90s. It was the height of the AIDS epidemic. It was pre-internet. And we were hired as community health outreach workers and paid double minimum wage. And we went into our communities and developed ourselves as leaders. I came to this work because I was hired at that organization in 1996 as a young person who'd grown up on the streets of the Tenderloin and been incarcerated 17 times. And the organization transformed my life because, to Dr. Kuvon's points, no one was trying to save me. I was in a community of other young people that looked like me. I was invested in. I had economic choice for the first time in my life. And my voice, I began to decriminalize myself and realize, wait, like, I'm not a bad kid. There's structural things at play here. And I actually can use my experience to transform. That's how I came to the work. I came back 8 years ago as executive director and in my new role and am working to expand our footprint.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lucero, and I am the director of a statewide office called the Office of Youth and Community Restoration, which was birthed out of a grassroots effort. Probably those of you here from communities and from Liberty Hill were championing that bill to close youth prisons statewide, carceral system, and have youth, what we call, realigned to counties for care and healing. Prior to my being appointed to this position, I was a Superior Court judge in Santa Clara County for 22 years, largely in courts that served families in crisis. So child welfare courts, family court, and juvenile justice court. I developed many therapeutic models while I was there, believing that families should be kept together at all cost, that substance use disorders is a mental health issue and not a carceral issue. And that I just believe we need to hold systems accountable and not individuals who are deeply, deeply disadvantaged by what our systems require them to do to have just a little bit of peace in their lives. Prior to that, I was a prosecutor and I specialized in crimes against children and the elderly as a deputy district attorney. I've met amazing people on this journey, including Jessica, who you'll hear more about our work later, but I can't tell you enough how there's a real thirst and hunger to give language to what judges see every day in the courtroom. People of color, poor people who are just knocked down again and again by our system's bureaucracy and the expectations of a system that people can do things that none of us could do.
Thank you. So, Dr. Kufson, you talked about this idea of remedy. You know, what I was hearing is it's both getting to the root causes and addressing it in a way that addresses the actual trauma behind the problem. So, you know, I would love to dig into what you all think are the root causes of these issues and the real solutions or the real remedies. And thinking about, you know, in 2021, the County Board of Supervisors declared that these jails are not suitable places for girls. And here we are, a couple of years later, and we've seen an increase in the number. We've actually seen a decrease in the total number of kids who are in jail, but an increase in the number of girls. And as we've heard, we know that Black girls in particular get arrested at younger ages for lesser offenses than their counterparts. So there's a lot of broad understanding of how broken the system is and a lot of sort of political commitment to it. And yet we're still here and we're still arresting and jailing more and more girls. So tell us, what do you think are the root causes and the real remedies? Start with Jessica and work our way down.
In 2017, when I was executive director at Young Women's Freedom Center, we watched 13, right? And there was one thing that Van said in the movie that, like, the systems will continue to transform. And we thought, well, how can we really end mass incarceration and criminalization if the story of how women and girls experience criminalization isn't told and understood? And so we had a convening in Oakland, and we're like, let's bring together 100 directly impacted women and girls and gender expansive people. And 200 people came. And we just spent a day talking about how are we criminalized. And in about 40 minutes, a group of 40 folks, we can tell our story. And so on the wall, they mapped out this super complicated web of entanglement that was their collective story, and they named her Hope. But it really starts at birth for poor young women, women of color that grew up in poverty, in public housing, in the way you're policed in public housing, when your family receives public assistance. I grew up knowing it as welfare, the way that you're criminalized. And California led the way for criminalization of food stamps, meaning that to qualify for food stamps, you had to have your refrigerator in your house inspected to make sure you really had a need. And, you know, for someone that had food stamps for my own children for many years, the $300 doesn't even get us through the month. So, and then there's the child welfare system, which so many girls enter early, and the majority of the time it's for conditions related to poverty. And so there's this kind of idea that we can take better care of your children. So we're going to separate you from our family. And then, of course, like sexual abuse. So there's all of these conditions that pile on that leave you less choice, less self-determination, that criminalize yourself, but also your family and also your community, that lead to the streets, to juvenile incarceration, you know, to foster care. So it's really the multiple pathways and this web. Those are the root causes. And I think it's also really important when we're looking at how do we end incarceration that we're also thinking about beyond that. Because even as we, you know, Young Women's Freedom Center we're here in Los Angeles, and the structural conditions that the young people that we're working with, even if they're not incarcerated, they're not better. They can't get jobs. People are experiencing significant homelessness. The sexual abuse, which does often start at families. But I mean, in Los Angeles, there's a 300-person class action lawsuit against the county for sexual abuse of girls while they're incarcerated. We also work in the women's prisons, and we're partnering with CDCR, holding CDCR accountable right now, for the rampant sexual abuse and rape of incarcerated women. And so for me, as I just want to end, and when I think about the trauma and lack of resources that young people are faced, and their resilience for figuring out how do I survive anyways in spite of all of these things. I just think it's very complex, and I'm kind of rambling.
Oh no, I love it. Thank you so much. Okay.
It is really complex. And if we actually knew the actual solution, who knows what would be possible. But I just want to say that, and I also hear the passion in when we have to discuss root causes. In the Professor Kelly Little's book, The City of the Incarcerated, LA Basin area, there was a Tongva tribe. And the mission priest used to, in the 1700s, put girls 8 and up who were unmarried, lock them in the missions at night so that they wouldn't be raped by the Spanish soldiers. We have a long history in this exact land that we're on of locking up girls to protect them. And what I'd like to say is that when we look at the history of the colonization, the history of how disposable people of color have been in California and throughout the United States, it is not surprising that a majority of the girls who are incarcerated today throughout California are girls of color, because we have a hierarchy of how we address, quote unquote, law violations. And I've talked to girls, in court, I've talked to girls not in court, and I've heard white girls say, if I was black or if I was Latina, I would have been arrested for this behavior. So I think we have to really get honest with ourselves about what we're seeing. We're seeing the pattern of the savior. Oh, and the priest said that they did this so that the girls could comport with the morals of their society, right? And how many times do we lock up the girl because the parent or whoever's in court saying, if you let her out, she'll just go back on the street with her pimps ready to pick her up on the corner. And I'm thinking, well, why aren't we arresting the pimp? I mean, I have a DA right here. Why aren't we doing a sting operation or something, right? Like this mentality, and I've been on calls too with judges from all over the nation, and the mentality that we lock girls up for their own safety and gender expansive youth is still with us. And that's why the ending girls incarceration is so important, because judges like me, and by the way, I am retired, I'm not an active judge, but judges like me who need that education about what the harm, the trauma, re-traumatizing, trauma-inducing facilities as the solution. So if I'm trying to do something good by protecting, but I learn that actually I'm creating more harm, that's important. And you know, the inertia of the status quo is powerful. If we don't begin to unpack this, and we are at a point in history where we can unpack this, I totally agree with Dr. Kusin. This is not a problem that we cannot solve. We just have to do it with our eyes wide open, be honest with ourselves, and ask ourselves why all the people in custody are people of color. Root cause, I don't know if I told you the root cause, but I can tell you what the momentum was for what we see today. You know what? We still think that we're doing the right thing in many cases, and we're not.
I will just add that racialized gender bias is a very specific thing that we do not often discuss or address in our conversations about remedy to this particular issue that is largely informed by all the ways that we misread, misunderstand, apply stereotypes and bias to trying to interpret data, to trying to interpret behaviors, to trying to interpret impact of systems. And we have to get better at that. And it starts with a host of internal work, which is why I do name that it is an issue. But it doesn't end with internal work, because this is also a very structural issue. People make policies. People make systems. And so, you know, however you might feel as an individual in terms of your expanded or limited capacity to understand some of these things, recognize that within your sphere of influence, what you understand, you apply to that. And so to continue doing the work to better understand means that you're also doing the work to better understand how you then have your impact on these systems and in these specific ways. I also think it's really important. We didn't talk about girls for a long, long time. I remember being one of a few hands, right? Like, what about the girls? What about the girls? Right. And I remember even in the deep, deep commitment around men and boys, saying what about the girls was not met with love. And it was partially, I think, years now later, because we had not addressed the role of men and boys in the harm against girls and women. And so because we were like, no, but let's not talk about it because this is going to lead to more incarceration here. Or if we talk about what's happening here, it's going to have a disparate impact here. And we didn't do a good job of recognizing that what if our goal is to build whole communities, safe communities, we have to talk about everyone along the gender continuum and how they are impacted and involved in this issue. So for our girls who are absolutely, you know, the first harm that 90% of our girls experience is sexual harm. Most of that harm is coming from the men in their lives. And so that was a hard thing for us to talk about, a very difficult thing to talk about. So part of the remedy is not hiding from the things that we know are contributing to the harm. Let's also, in our talk about how we are responding to girls, talk about what is needed for us to end the rape and sexual violence against them. Mm. What do men and boys need in this space? Boys are also impacted by sexual violence. Like, let's talk about all these things. And so that's the piece that makes this a call for us to be much more rigorous in our investment strategies and our discussions about some of these things. So before I was at Grantmakers for Girls of Color, I founded an organization called the National Black Women's Justice Institute. One of the projects that we did was to take a look in California at how boys could be allies against sexual violence against girls. Like, we are the National Black Women's Justice Institute. We're talking about girls. Let's have a project on boys, right? Let's talk to the boys also about what they are internalizing. How are they living with the same tropes and stereotypes that everyone else is, that is leading them to be facilitators of harm, sometimes without them even realizing what role they're playing. And so there's a massive redirection of resources that needs to take place, a redirection of resources in schools, why our budgets are so big for law enforcement and so small for other necessary actions and interventions in our schools still escapes me, given what we know now and what research has provided for us in knowing the impacts of these things. But again, our commitment to leading policies and interventions with fear is leading us to a dead end. We have to engage in other modalities and invest in these modalities in order for us to deepen our connection with each other and to build out whole spaces for our young people to thrive.
Oh, thank you for that, all of that. You know, one thing that's sitting with me now after hearing all of that is, I remember being a kid, and some of you know about my childhood as single parent and poor and all sorts of unfortunes along the line of what we're talking about. And I remember very clearly knowing and like being told that if you try to go get help, it'll just be worse. Mm-hmm. Like, whoever you think is going to help you, whether it's the police or you know, some system that's set up for kids or victims, they will punish you and they will punish the people you love. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of seeking help and safety seemed so just terrifying. Yeah. So that's sitting with me. And I'm also thinking about what you said about sort of the unwittingly becoming facilitators of harm, the tremendous harm that's been done in the name of safety. I mean, really, what do you think about? When you think about safety, what do you, like, you probably think about harmful systems and the people that are supposed to make us safe are the exact ones who are criminalizing us and taking away our freedom. But, you know, one thing I want to talk about is, you know, the one could argue that the population of young women and gender expansive youth that we're talking about is, you know, a minority of the overall population. And we're going to be super clear and super rigorous about how we address that. But I do think that in addressing this specific harm and this specific, you know, fighting for freedom for a specific group, that we're fighting for liberation for all of us. And I'm curious, how you think about that, you know, not in any way to minimize the focus on girls and gender expansive youth, but, and my own trajectory too is coming from sort of being a victim of these systems to now not being a victim. So what does that mean? Am I an unwitting facilitator? Am I benefiting from these systems? You know, what I more feel is that my soul is crushed by having to exist within these systems, even if I'm not actively perpetuating harm. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, how is fighting for liberation for this group really liberation for all of us? Maybe we can start with Dr. Koopson and go the other way.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time there, in thinking about that, because I am of the belief that if you are truly engaging an intersectional analysis to approaching how we build out systems of remedy for this particular population, that we will also then, by addressing some of the most marginalized populations in this conversation, make sure that we are reaching everyone else. The other thing is the wellness of women and girls always comes with the wellness of whole communities. Always. Mm-hmm. And so no matter where in the world I am, when I talk to them about what the investment is for girls and women, they're all like, yeah, because girls will come back to their community and boys take it and go. Right. And so just the nature of how systems and societies are working, girls are responsible for this work. And I'm also always one to say, but our investment in girls also needs to be because they are worthy, period. Mm-hmm. Period. Right. And them being seen as worthy of investment means that we are reaching, again, the most marginalized, which brings everyone into view. Mm. The reason I started talking about criminalization over incarceration, because it broadens the lens. When I started talking about school to confinement pathways for girls, it allowed us to talk about school dress codes. It allowed us to talk about hairstyles. Mm. It allowed us to talk about sexual violence and intimate partner violence. It broadened the scope. When you talk about girls, you inherently broaden the scope. It is inherently rigorous and inclusive.
I couldn't agree more. I also think that the more we are able to normalize in the public discourse this concept of treating youth as youth, that it does begin to permeate the consciousness. Treating girls as girls. We're at a time where we have these smaller populations, period. Over the last 20 years, I think there's been a 70% reduction of arrests, citations, incarceration. We're getting to do a deep dive. The girls are one layer, but we also have very young kids. So there's other layers. There was a study done in San Diego. Dr. Lyons did a study in San Diego of the incarcerated youth. 24% had fetal alcohol syndrome disorder. So there's neurodiverse issues. There's literacy issues. If we can start getting our arms around these complexities, we all win. Every human has inherent worth and dignity assessment. Mm-hmm. The lens is every human deserves inherent youth and dignity. Mm-hmm. And what is the unique thing about this youth, this child, this girl, this boy, that we need to address and respond to, unless we just want to use our public taxpaying dollars for naught. This is a smart approach. This isn't an approach that will not bear fruit for everybody, because we're normalizing approaching the one by one with these smaller populations. That's what we need to do. It is not a silver bullet. There is not a one size fits all. These are children. And we stand in the shoes of the parent when we think that we can do better. So we better do better.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I would like to add is that, you know, I'm privileged to been with this organization for the past 25 years. My approach to the work is about leadership, right? Like, what does it look like to invest in the leadership of these young people? Not just to get out of juvenile hall and to have everything that they need to live happy lives, but that if we want to really build a world where there's freedom and liberation for everyone, we also need different leaders and people with different points of view and experiences. And so what I'm so honored to be able to see is that, you know, my cohort of young people that I grew up with the center who had similar experiences to me are having huge impact in the world, right? It's much more beyond than just any incarceration. I mean, there's like people in public office, people running philanthropy, running organizations, like in all sectors. And it's really about bringing these values of freedom and liberation and the nuanced things you know when you've experienced long-term deep poverty, when you've experienced incarceration, and then you're able to bring that to Sacramento and have that inform the policies. And so I think that's where I always sit with it for the long term. Mm.
Who knows Liberty Hill's motto? Change, not charity. That's right. So I'm thinking about that. And one of the things that I really love about the Liberation Fund is that it really tries to sort of marry the best of not charity, because that's not what we do, but really a change-oriented way of supporting individuals with their immediate needs. And it's a tricky balance. Often we see a segmentation of, like, either, you know, you're working with folks on service provision and dealing with immediate crisis, or you're going upstream and doing advocacy and systems change. And in the Liberation Fund, and certainly you three are extraordinary examples of really trying to do all of that all at once. And I would love to just hear from each of you, how do you balance it personally in the work that you're, you know, you're working with young women and gender expansive youth, they're in horrific crisis, and then you're also tackling these monstrous, you know, national and global systems in your everyday work. So just want to better understand, how are you balancing that, and how do you kind of think about how that work gets done all at the same time? Well, let's start with Jessica. Yeah.
For me, there's no other paradigm, there's no other option. Coming to a youth organization as a directly impacted young person, and from day one being told you're powerful. I literally remember my first time public speaking, and my coworker Latifa, like, pulled me up at City Hall and was like, "You're the only one that's been incarcerated in this room. They need to hear that." And so I think that our model and strategy has always been that these young people have so much to offer right now where they're at, and how do we cultivate space for them to find their voice, realize their brilliance, you know, go through healing, and also be the advocates that we need. And I think that that is the way of transformation. You know, we have a coalition called Sister Warriors, and there's thousands of members across the state, incarcerated and not. And, you know, we have monthly calls where we're talking about which policies are we going to focus on this year. And we're getting letters from the prisons. And so all of that is just, I just don't know another way. And it's, I think, important for all of us to be doing our personal work, the outer work, the policy work, because some of the lines we think about are false, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I always think, like, even beyond intersectional, I'm a whole person from a whole family, from a whole community. You know, some of it might be a little bit broken, but it's still whole. And so a lot of the lines we make are false lines so that we could easily understand and compartmentalize.
It's in my DNA. I am the oldest daughter of a teenage couple and lived in Section 8 housing and was told by my mom not to tell the social worker that my dad was visiting. My mother is 81. She's a social worker. She still supervises students for Cal State University, Sacramento. I don't know any other way either. I always just wanted to be of the greatest and maximum love and service for my community. And I've always said that my job was to make myself ready for the call. And I've been so fortunate to have had education. And by the way, education is a great healer of many things, and it is a remedy. California really lags in public education, in case you all didn't know that. But when we have good 0 to 5, good elementary, that's how we change the world. Yeah. When we care as much about each child as I care about my child, my children, my girls, yeah, I would have done anything for their dreams to come true. And when we care enough, then that's what happens. But so how do I balance that? Well, I have a huge faith. I know that I'm not in charge. Yes. I know that I answer to greater powers. Sometimes that's the governor. Sometimes that's somebody else. I know that I'm just a cog in this web of humanity, and that the greatest thing I can do is keep myself centered, to keep myself clear, to be honest and transparent about what I'm seeing, no matter what role I'm in. I also take vitamins and I do a lot of yoga. And I have an amazing husband, Matt Trask. In fact, in a week, it'll be our 32nd wedding anniversary.
I think, like you, my goal is to walk in alignment with my divine assignment. That's how I say it. And I say it to myself every day because there are often times when, you know, I have been asked to participate in different elements of that and it has taken many turns. That is okay. And so I walk where I'm supposed to be at that moment. Mm-hmm. If that means I'm in Geneva, I'm in Geneva. If I'm in front of a young person and meet in real time, I'm in front of a real person. If the congresswoman is calling me saying we want an ending push-out bill, I'm helping her organize the language for that. Mm. Like, it is, for me, the commitment is that if we are intending to have a space where no child is disposable, and that is what I'm divinely put here to facilitate and help move along, then I will be where I need to be. And I drink water and I go to sleep and I talk to my own children about what they are experiencing. I have two girls and they have informed a lot of this for me. And they keep me aware of language generational concerns. They keep me connected to their peers in a very authentic way. They offer critique when it is necessary.
Always.
They come to my lectures. They give me feedback. They do all these things, and they always have. So they have been with me in this journey and, you know, exercise their power in that way. And I think I never was a person who said, you know, you're too small to be a part of this conversation. Right? I don't believe in that. The small people have some of the most critical analyses. And so, however that looks, if it's in age small, if it's in power small, if it's in location small, like the people we might consider small are the people I want to talk to about what is necessary. So it is about balance. And it also is about being, I think, committed to your own practice of being in community as well. Because I'm very clear, G4GC doesn't do it all alone. I don't do it all alone. We have an ecosystem, right? We have community. We have folks. We talk to each other all the time, right? As a grantee partner of ours, we consider you a co-investor. So there's a lot of interplay that creates the balance naturally.
I think I'm going to start thinking of the critiques my kids give me in that positive light. You know? They're my biggest critics. Their main critique, though, is that I'm very old. And that... And then all of my ideas are irrelevant because they're from the 1900s. So, key to my success. Okay. So I would love now to dig into we've talked a lot about sort of the ideas and the philosophies and the experience. I really want to hear about some of the work specifically. I know this is hard to do, but if you could each think about one strategy or one program. I mean, Jessica herself has like 500 organizational tenets. She just creates a new organization every day. Building housing, you know, providing services. Pick one and really walk us through, you know, what is that strategy and what difference is it going to make? And this time, let's start with the judge and then we'll go out to the doctor from there.
I love bringing the work that I did at the county level to the state level. We did a lot of different projects in the county, Santa Clara County. One of them that I love best, besides ending girls' incarceration, was getting an educational champion for every probation youth and for designing an educational health assessment and demanding that every kid that comes into the juvenile hall door get an educational assessment just like they get a medical assessment and a mental health assessment. I wanted an educational health assessment. I believe not only that education is a protective factor, it is everything because it is the brain that has the power to do enormous good on the planet. I wanted to instill a love of learning and to make sure I knew I couldn't give kids new homes. I knew I couldn't give kids new parents. I couldn't give them new cars, but I could give them the love of learning and to have them leave me literate, thinking that they're college material, connecting them to an educational rights advocate if needed. There was a lawyer out of the Bay who ended up in the Midwest who said he used to be a defense attorney, a criminal defense attorney for kids. He went to another profession. He became an educational rights attorney. And he said if every third grader had an educational rights attorney, there would be no prison. So I'm taking my educational advocacy to the state level. This is exciting to me. And there's a lot of work to do, let me just tell you.
G4GC, we have a concept called reciprocity as praxis. And the idea is that by giving and investing and being in right relationship through reciprocal relationship, and when we practice that, that's how we grow our investments in all the ways. Yes, we have like four funds that we move money through. In doing that, I have conversations with people in different ways all the time. I have different kinds of conversations with people in every book. The strategy I want to elevate now is the one that is the latest one, which is talking to the girls directly. Because there have been a lot of conversations like this, but the next strategy I have is really to locate with the girls and young people themselves who will read Charisma's Turn, the opportunity for them to see not just themselves, but what's possible in what could be a push-out scenario, but what happens when you have at least one adult on campus that you trust and that can bring you into right relationship with the school and that can hold you and your educational journey rather than push you away. To me, the strategy that I find compelling, in addition to all the things that we do through our reciprocity as praxis, is the strategy to expose young people to the language around how to lead with their purpose and how to challenge when they find themselves being punished in that space. And some of the ways to do that is just to model it, which is why I did a graphic novel, right? To model it, to walk them through it, to storytell it, to tap into the ways of knowing that are beyond the statistical data or some of the other things or policy analyses that we might read, but that they are absolutely not reading, but to get them into a space to say, I believe in environmental justice. And because I believe in environmental justice, but I got into a fight with this girl in school, you know, I shouldn't be kept out of the youth groups that are doing environmental justice work. But how do I get back over to these youth groups that are doing environmental justice work when I'm being suspended? Right. So to talk to young people about how to negotiate their own well-being and hopefully to tap into some of the adults that might be working with those young people to get them to identify specific elements of their character and talent that will lead them into a right relationship with our community.
What I appreciate both of you is this, like, you excite me about education and the possibilities. I mean, for me, I did drop out of school in seventh grade, and I haven't really went back. I have my GED, but I...
That's because you were pushed.
Yeah, I was pushed out, and school was violent. It was not a good experience for me, and I see this having been in the work for so many years. You know, we sat at a staff meeting, and we're just like, how many of us were in special ed? And it was our whole staff, right? We were all in special ed. But in this work, I've been able to, you know, visit Stanford and go to all these places and Mills College graduations and just bring young people to feel the possibilities of, like, wait, you get space and you're taken care of and to dream and think. And so I guess the project that I'm most excited about in all of the work that we do, and I do like to create new organizations, in part because the magic that we've created at Young Women's Freedom Center is space for young people who've been told their lives they're nothing. You're bad. Like, even when you're on welfare, you want to be a nurse? Absolutely not. But you could be a nurse assistant, right? Mm-hmm. So your box is small. Don't dream, don't talk too much, don't think big, because these possibilities aren't really for you. And so, to me, the most important project is to create space for young people who've been pushed out of school, who've been on the streets, who've just been in survival mode to think about the possibilities. Mm-hmm. It's literally what motivates me in this work. Like, and we cultivate learning. I haven't been back to school because I've been busy, but, you know... We have Circle, and these are young people that are reading Bell Hooks, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, like, and are excited about learning, critical thinking about their lives, but also what would it look like to end incarceration? What are the strategies we can develop? And so for me, what's just important in all these projects is to create the space for people to, in community, build, dream, begin to learn, and then to be able to place themselves in our society in different places, mm-hmm. because they have that kind of fire that really society and these systems that we're talking about have really done a lot to crush.
The last question is for Judge Lucero and Jessica about Santa Clara County. What did you accomplish there and how did you do it?
This is really important to me, this work. And I remember we were at the Policy Link conference in mm-hmm. Chicago, yeah. and we finally got a chance to just sit down and talk about the possibilities. Young Women's Freedom Center had been around for, I don't know, 27 years in San Francisco. Judge Lucero came to visit us, and like almost all city departments, I think. And we did a big circle with the young people. And for us, what we always do is create space for everyone to just be human. We were thinking about expanding beyond San Francisco, but the kind of work that was happening and really the pool to bring us down there was amazing. And our thought was the model of the Young Women's Freedom Center. I talked about it already a lot, but the other part of the work that we've always done is to partner directly with the young people to talk about what is it that you want and need for your life, right? What is going on with your case, with your home, but like, what is it that you want? And how do we show up and partner with you so that you can begin to make self-determined choices for your lives? Yeah, we launched in Santa Clara, and the goal was to build infrastructure and alternatives to end the incarceration of girls. It was a deep partnership with the judge, with, you know, social services, with probation. For us, the main part of the work is partnering with young people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The other part I just want to lift up of how we expand, we're here in Los Angeles as well, is we apply our model and hire young people from that community to lead the work, mm-hmm. right? So, and that part's really the key ingredient, right? Like the young, our leaders here in LA, I mean, they're from the neighborhoods, they know what's going on, like mm-hmm. they're, and then we're kind of creating space for them to develop and lead. Our strategy has always been, we're very clear on what we're fighting for, right? Freedom, end of these systems, liberation. And that means we also don't have to wait for probation to finally get through the bureaucratic policy commission report to implement something, mm-hmm. that we could begin showing up day one, mm-hmm. in partnership, advocating and finding the allies and champions, which really is such a huge difference. Mm-hmm. The work is still happening, has expanded in Santa Clara County, and we're working to bring that model here.
So the goal was to end incarceration of girls, yeah. in Santa Clara County, and where are we on that?
What I can tell you is my last day on the bench, which was January 14th, 2022, after working for several years with the Young Women's Freedom Center and the Vera Institute for Justice, there were zero girls in custody. That was on my last day. And there was also simultaneously a girl who I did not, of course, put in custody because she wasn't a public safety risk, but she had 50 CPS referrals. So I just want you to know the variety that we see. And by the way, most girls are incarcerated in the state of California for misdemeanors and status offenses. So in case anybody's wondering if anybody's soft on crime, that's really not the issue.
What's a status offense?
It's for truancy, curfew violation, running away. It's an offense that is created because of your age. We had a gender responsive task force in Santa Clara County that started, I think it was like 2015. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact timeline. We brought in a Young Women's Freedom Center after Jessica and I met in Chicago. We brought in the Vera Institute for Justice because we applied to be part of their EGI group. But in any event, we met monthly. The Office of Women's Policy was one of the co-chairs. Probation was a co-chair. I was a co-chair. OWP fed us because it's important that we feed one another at lunchtime when we meet. And we just started knocking it out, you guys. Those girls used to be brought in pink. They were brought in pink uniforms. And we thought, you know what? Let's start here. let's do low-hanging fruit. We became a gender responsive county. And then the probation deputy chief said, why are we focusing on making things better for girls in custody? Let's keep them out of custody. And we're like, yay. And so thereafter, probation had a designated person who just helped the girls who came to the front door. So that's a big deal in county speak. Okay. It's a code. It's a position. So we had specialized case management. We had specialized response. We had family finding. We started to bring in these concepts from child welfare so that there couldn't be an excuse. We had DSS come, social services. So we started this amazing collaboration, a government collaboration. And by the way, that is the golden ticket for government. You want to bring all the partners who touch that child. Imagine a child with five parents. That's a child in custody. And they all have their own attorney. By the way, every one of those government agencies. So you have to really figure out the protocols, change protocols. And that's what we did. We started changing our protocols. And so today it is still thriving under Chief Nick Burchard. There's been a changeover in chiefs. We have the DA. I think Vera met with the DA, met with the public defender. They're golden, you guys. They know how to get this done. So it is still going. And I think that's the hallmark of of changing infrastructure is when it's still going after key people leave.
And I think the other thing at Young Ones Freedom Center, our model is always like, you know, we're not saving the girls, we're investing in them. And the young people who came to Young Women's Freedom Center instead of incarceration have led significant advocacy work in the county. They advocated at the Board of Supervisors for dollars to be shifted to support young moms. They did a whole year-long research project there. There was another project where we did a GBI program or UBI project for girls that had been exploited that has been really successful. And all of this has come from the advocacy and organizing work of young people that were otherwise in custody.
Wonderful.
Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for today's preseason episode. We're so excited to announce that a new season of our hit podcast is officially on the way. Stay tuned for season 3 and be sure to join us for new episodes, exciting new guests, and engaging conversations as we explore the theme of igniting electoral power and defending our democracy. In the meantime, you can revisit all of season 1 and 2 episodes here or on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share your favorite episodes with your friends. We'll see you soon for more conversations from the front lines.